Good afternoon to everyone and welcome to this event. My name is Jonathan White and I'm Professor of Politics at the European Institute of the LSE. And I'm very pleased to be chairing this event on the politics of the far right in Central and Southeast Europe. This is an event which is co-hosted by the Ratio Forum within the Central and Southeast Europe program at LSE Ideas. And today we're looking at right-wing authoritarian politics as it arises in a number of countries in the region, what unites it, and also what unites the critique of it. Is there a coherent ideology which underpins far-right politics and perhaps even extends beyond the far right to encompass other strands of politics in the region? Where does it draw its appeal from, and what are the responses that it does attract and indeed should attract? How should it be approached? These are some of the questions that we'll be looking at in today's discussion, and also how the politics of a particular part of Europe feeds into wider, more global trends to do with authoritarianism and the far right in Europe and beyond. We've got today four expert speakers to tackle these themes. And before we kick off, I shall just say a few words about who we've got. We've got, first of all, Dr. Luke Cooper, who's a consultant, associate researcher at LSE Ideas. He's the author of a new report on exactly this topic, on authoritarian protectionism in Central, Eastern and Southeastern Europe, and also of a book, which I believe is coming out around about now, on authoritarian contagion, the global threat to democracy. Our second speaker is Biljana Gyarova-Vegetseda, who's one of the founders of the Bulgarian Institute for Legal Initiatives and is its current director of the foundation. Before this, she worked as a senior staff attorney at the American Bar Association, Central and Eastern European Law Initiative. Our third speaker is Rafał Pankowski, who's professor at the Institute of Sociology of Collegium Civitas in Warsaw. And Rafał has published widely on racism, nationalism, populism, xenophobia, and other issues, including books such as Neo-Fascism in Western Europe, Racism and Popular Culture, and the Populist Radical Right in Poland. And our fourth speaker today is going to be Luisa Slavkova, who's director of the Sophia Platform Foundation. She's an advisory board member of the European Network for Civic Education. And in 2021, she co-founded the Pan-European Platform for Civic Education, the Civics Innovation Hub. She's also the author and editor of several books and publications on foreign policy, democracy, development, and civic education. So these are the four speakers that we've got for the event this afternoon. I'll say a few words briefly before we start about the format. We shall let each speaker give an opening intervention of around about 7 or 8 minutes to frame the discussion on their terms. Once we've been through all our speakers, we'll then go back to our speakers in order to allow them to comment on the interventions of other speakers, and we'll start something of a panel discussion in that fashion. And then later on in the course of the event, we've got time for a Q&A session when we will be welcoming interventions from you, the audience. A few final reminders. One is the event is being recorded and will be made into a podcast. Secondly, if you want to tweet, then the hashtag is, I believe it's on a slide that you will have seen when you came in. It's the hashtag LSE Ratio Forum. And as I say, if you want to participate in the Q&A that's coming later on, then just use the Q&A function on the Zoom platform. Okay, great. I think that's everything I need to say just to frame things. So let's go over to our first speaker, which is going to be Luke Cooper.
Thanks, Jonathan. Hi, everyone. So I guess my take on what we're talking about today is leaning in a way heavily into the description of the event, is the way in which the far-right rhetoric has become normalized among elites. And this isn't just a Central Eastern and Southeastern issue, it's a global phenomena. And I'll come back at the end at what I think is the real, to talk about what I think is the real significance of what's happening in Central Eastern and Southeastern Europe for tackling this global phenomenon. And on the other hand, I think we're seeing across the region a kind of flowering of civic resistance to this politics that we want to talk about. And so, yeah, as Jonathan says, I've got a book out this week, and I've also written a report for LSE Ideas, which will be published shortly. And it looks at political events and elite discourses in six different states, the report does, that is, Bulgaria, Romania, Slovakia, Czech Republic, alongside the perhaps more widely talked about examples of Hungary and Poland. And it tries to identify a set of commonalities within elite discourses within these countries and commonalities of resistance. So in choosing these case studies, that I think we're going to get a chance to discuss some of them in a bit more depth this afternoon, I think has two particular effects and advantages, if you like. The first is it helps us to de-exceptionalize this issue. I don't know, I suppose I approached this question in a way that was recognizing certainly the significance of what's happening in Hungary and Poland, but wanted to really, especially amongst the EU elite, if you like, challenge the idea that the European Union's illiberalism problem is just a Hungarian and Polish issue and nothing else. I think we need to, as academics, push back on that idea quite strongly and really draw out the commonalities that exist not only in Europe but also globally in how authoritarian politics is being manifested. And in doing so, you know, really draw out the extent to which democracy is being challenged all over the world. Secondly, I think these cases are really helpful in that regard, because it reveals how the normalization of far-right politics is both ideologically coherent, because many of the same discourses are being used all over the place, frankly, and then also perhaps paradoxically point out that even though it's got this very high level of ideological coherence, it's also something that we find examples of on the left of politics, or the center left, the political center, and the center right and far right. And I think this tells us the success that the far right has had in normalizing many of their ideas. So politics that would have once been seen on the fringes of European and global politics has really come increasingly into the mainstream and can be found across the whole political spectrum formally defined. And this is what I call in the book authoritarian protectionism. And I've used this as a simple rubric to understand and group together, if you like, these tendencies and practices that we find in the new authoritarian politics. And I think, so authoritarian protectionism offers a very strong definition of the national community on ethnic lines, and usually some kind of sharp distinction to groups deemed as foreign outsiders or their social liberal cosmopolitan supporters, often using masculine imagery and rejecting to different degrees a social liberal agenda. And it moves quite quickly or easily from this discursive idea to saying, on the other hand, that these group, this ethnically defined nation, the true patriotic and legitimate members of the community, well, they have partisan interests as a group that are counterposed to others. And this becomes quite a dangerous move for democratic politics, because it basically rejects the need for any form of pluralism. So if members of the insider group believe that their partisan interests have an absolute primacy over and above all other considerations, political leaders may well be able to persuade them, and indeed I think this has happened, to attack democratic institutions. And one further result of this is that it leads into a set of governing practices, because it encourages power to be used autocratically without the respect that democracy needs for the rule of law and fair political competition. And we see these tendencies very widely across these cases, that the monitoring and regulatory functions of public institutions are often challenged in favor of patronage, clientelism, and excessive centralization. This might involve coercing the media or subjecting it to some form of state interference and oligarchic patronage. And this means, as a result of these governing practices, that either as either due to conscious design or a consequence of eroding the rule of law, then you're going to get corruption. You're going to get economic corruption and a blurring of distinction between the public and private sphere. So a very strong link to crony capitalism. So rule of law crises, a challenge to fair political competition, but not, thankfully and importantly, or not yet anyway, the full overthrow of democracy. So it's what Shalini Randeria has also called a kind of soft authoritarianism. So the cases I've examined and looked at for the report, I looked at Romania, the Social Democrats associated with Liviu Dragnea and Victor Ponta, regimes that have now fallen from power, a regime that has fallen from power as a result of mass protest. Robert Fico in Slovakia, another very, very authoritarian experience that Europe has had and should talk more about. Again, mass protests brought about his fall from power over corruption. So those are forces aligned with the political left, but we also have seen Babis and his ally, President Miloš Zeman in the Czech Republic, that came to power on an anti-corruption, pro-citizen rights agenda, at least in Babis's case, but has governed very in a very corrupt way. He's a billionaire, really blurring the distinctions between public and private sphere. Again, we've seen mass protests in that case, but not successful this time. So on the left and on the center, we see these practices. We've also seen in Bulgaria too, the Borisov regime that has governed in alliance with the far right since 2017. And these cases all exist alongside the more commonly talked about examples in Hungary and Poland. I think there are a series of common threads we can see across these cases, a gender scare over the Istanbul Convention, sweeping attacks on sex education, abortion rights, and the freedoms of the LGBT plus community. Most recently, of course, in Hungary in this regard, but it's a really common tendency. We see ethno-nationalist rhetoric, especially in reference to Muslim immigration during the migration crisis and the Roma community. We also see some use of some kind of conspiracy theory, maybe the construction of alternative ecosystems of ideas through online communities that serve to radically challenge the truthful reporting of events. And we also see, yes, that corruption and patronage politics, that power centralization. So I'll just finish by saying two further things. On the one hand, we shouldn't exceptionalize these cases. So there's a really strong European context here. And we have to be clear, I'm afraid, that the European Union has created a very tolerant environment internationally for the emergence of authoritarian politics over the last 15 years. The example I would use to draw this out would be the 2006 suspension of the Robert Fico from the Party of European Socialists. He was readmitted 2 years later, and he was suspended over going into alliance with the far-right Slovak National Party. Now, that event, I think, really foreshadows tolerant atmosphere created in European politics after this. And secondly, and really encouragingly, I think we need to start talking about these cases, not simply as a rule of law crisis in Central and Eastern Europe, which is maybe the dominant European Union discourse, but we should start talking about Romania, Slovakia, Bulgaria, Poland, Czech Republic. These are all cases and states that have seen huge mass demonstrations for democracy. In all five of those cases over the last 2 or 3 years, mass civic mobilizations that have been widely reported as the biggest since 1989. So I think we really need to urge Democrats across the whole of Europe and in Brussels especially to maybe flip how we're talking about the European democratic crisis and say, rather than saying Central and Eastern Europe is the heart of the rule of law crisis, perhaps we should be talking about it as the heart of the democratic upsurge, the new democratic spring, which is challenging authoritarian protectionism.
Great. Thanks very much, Luke. Bill Yana.
Thank you very much. Thank you to the London School of Economics and Political Sciences for inviting me to contribute to this very interesting and very timely topic, I should say. I will be talking from a practical point of view, working in the area of judicial and legal reform and anti-corruption for more than 20 years now. Let me start with completely agreeing with what Dr. Cooper said before me, that we should start talking more about Romania, Bulgaria, and Slovakia, and the other countries from Southeastern Europe. Because in Bulgaria, the situation is not more different than in Poland and Hungary, if not worse. So we have since 2009, for the last 12 years, the same party governing the country in various combinations and with very small gaps in between with caretaker governments. And the peak of this creeping authoritarian regime, as I call it, started with the last government, Borisov III, from 2017, in which GERB, this is the name of the ruling party, married to the far right, labeled here as patriotic nationalistic coalition, and ruled for the last 4 years. The culmination of this ruling was the deepening of the capturing of the state in all various ways, capturing of the media, capturing of the judiciary, and capturing of the regulators. We are currently also witnessing a step-by-step capturing of the academia, but I really hope that this will not happen in such a deep way as it is happening in Hungary, for example. The other outcome from this marriage was also the institutionalization of the corruption in the country, meaning that the legislative, the parliament, was serving the needs of the executive and producing legislation which basically legalized corrupt schemes in all various ways, including also fraud and violation of the main procurement principles. So as Dr. Cooper said, this led first in 2013 to a very large protest, which continued for more than a year, and led to the establishment of a caretaker government. Last year, in the summer of 2020, a second large protest started, and I can say that it still continues. But this time it was different. It was led mainly by young people, people who have returned to the country due to the COVID-19 situation all over the world, and who were demanding transparent and accountable governing and transparent and accountable institutions. What made this protests unique for the European Union, I must say, is that the second demand of these people, of all of us, I was also protesting on the streets, was the resignation of the prosecutor general in the country. I haven't heard of a member state where people have protested for the resignation of a person who is part of the judiciary. And in Bulgaria, the prosecutors are part of the judiciary. So you might ask yourselves why this is like this. In the answer is that in Bulgaria, the prosecutor general is, let's say, the most powerful figure, regardless if we talk about the executive, the legislative, or the judiciary, because it really has very broad powers. It has 7 years of mandate. And there is no mechanism to hold this person accountable, a topic which was criticized by the European Commission on various occasions in the CVM reports and also by the Venus Commission and other European institutions. And here I want to mention also something which I believe should be underlined and perhaps might bring to a further discussion. In my opinion, there is a difference between what is going on in Central Europe and what is going on in South and Eastern Europe and also in Bulgaria. And I will try to illustrate this with the saying we say in we have in Bulgaria, which is that a bald head is not cut by a sword. And by this, I would like to say that in all these years, in 2007, the Bulgarian government has managed to keep a low profile and has very quickly learned how to satisfy the European Commission and the other European institutions. And that is why the monitoring and the evaluation of the processes in Bulgaria were not so strong as perhaps in Hungary and in Poland, and did not lead to such harsh measures which are currently taken against Hungary and Poland. Having said this, as I also mentioned in the beginning, this doesn't mean that the process in Bulgaria are not even deeper than in the other countries from Central Europe. All this creeping authoritarian regime basically created in Bulgaria something which I would like to call democracy without a content. Because let's say the European institutions and the EU can only function at its best when the institutions at the national level are functioning in a transparent, accountable, and efficient way. And if you have institutions like in Bulgaria, which in most of their part are corrupt, not accountable, and not functioning in a transparent way, this is projecting also on the European institutions. And this is why I believe the EU is so weak at the moment and is looking for an answer. And at the end of my presentation, I would like to throw some ideas which perhaps can be seen also as answers to what the European Union and what all of us can do. First of all, we should not be afraid of what was said in the mid-70s by the Belgian Prime Minister at that time, Leo Tindemans, about the Europe at different speeds. This is absolutely natural in my opinion, and there is nothing to be afraid of. There will be always different speeds in Europe. But what we can make in that sense is, first of all, look for more unified policies at a European level. What I mean is, and I will give you the example with the European Prosecutor's Public Office. This is something which I believe is a success of the European Union and is a step towards the unification of certain policies at a European level and not only at the country level. And the European prosecution has just started functioning on the 1st of June, and I believe that it should be even more supported. And here comes the second idea I would like to throw for a debate, and this is the increasing or the broadening of the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. Because at the moment, the European prosecution will be relying for its indictments to the national courts. However, we should find and we should look and we should find for a court for the European prosecution and also for other European institutions. And I believe this should be the European Court of Justice. For this, however, it will need a very solid political backup. On the third place is the functioning or the real implementation of the various evaluation and monitoring tools which were developed through the years. And here I don't mean the CVM, because I believe the CVM has exhausted its powers. I turn more to the newly established and presented last year rule of law report. And I on purpose don't call it a mechanism, because so far it is not coupled with a really functioning mechanism. Only once when it is coupled with some mechanism, which I'm afraid should perhaps include also some financial restrictions, only then we could really say that the rule of law report is a rule of law, is a mechanism safeguarding the rule of law in Europe. And last but not least, as a fourth idea, I would also like to throw the potential which I believe exists in the Conference on the Future of Europe initiative. It is labeled as a major pan-European exercise, but I really do hope that it will not remain only an exercise, but what will come up from it will turn into real EU policies which will unite and not divide. And going back to the notion for the different speeds, as long as we look at the same direction and not look in different directions, I don't think that there will be a problem moving with different speeds. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks very much, Biljana. We'll go next to Rafael.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to this discussion. I would like to say I agree with the previous speakers. We are talking about a global issue, but I think the Polish case is a little bit special, and I hope it does not sound too nationalistic if I say that. Why is that? I think Poland has been often referred to as a successful example of democratic transition, of democratic transformation over the last three decades. It has often been referred to as the model of positive democratic transformation, and I think in a way Poland has demonstrated that some of the assumptions of the science of democratic transformation have been weak. I think some of the assumptions that we that we witnessed, that we experienced in Poland and elsewhere, especially in the 90s, and especially on the part of the so-called liberal elites. I think a big part of those assumptions amounted to a linear model of transformation. So something that takes us from point A to point B, and it's a process that is a one-way process, a one-way street, so to say. And I think what we have seen in the last years is the opposite of that. What we have witnessed tells us that democratic transformation is not a one-way street, and this assumption has been proved wrong. And I think since at least 2015, we could talk about a crisis of democratic culture and democratic values in the case of Poland. But if we look at the electoral campaign, the presidential campaign last year in 2020, I think we could really talk about a breakdown of democratic culture and democratic standards of political discourse at the very mainstream of democratic debate. And what the campaign last year amounted to really was the vilification of minorities. It was very much focused on the vilification of LGBT people, and it was very much focused on playing the anti-Semitic card. And I think for many different reasons, this is striking and shocking to note in the 21st century in the heart of Europe. That a successful political campaign could really focus so much on such tropes, and I also want to touch upon the issue of internationalization of nationalism, which is of course a paradoxical phenomenon. But if you look at the so-called Independence Day march in Poland every year on the 11th of November, it's a march organized by far-right nationalist groups, which started as a small event, but it became bigger and bigger every year. And by now, it became the biggest far-right nationalist event in Europe, or probably in the world. And interestingly and paradoxically, it is no longer just a Polish event, because it brings together far-right nationalist and racist groups from all over Europe and beyond. And I think it symbolizes and illustrates this really paradoxical aspect of the internationalization of the far right movement. But the internationalization of the far right is not only illustrated in terms of street marches. It is also illustrated on the level of parliamentary politics. And I actually want to mention the role of the British Conservative Party in this, because that was relatively well covered, the role that the British Tory Party played in forming alliances with far-right groups in the European Parliament before Brexit. But let's not forget that after Brexit, Britain still remains a member of the Council of Europe, which includes the Council of Europe Parliamentary Assembly. And if you look at the composition of the political groups within the Council of Europe Parliamentary Assembly, I think few people realize that the British Conservative Party is there in one group, in alliance, so legitimizing far-right parties from across the continent, including Germany, including Poland and Italy and many other countries. So I think this aspect is relatively it is still relatively under researched, and I think it should be talked about much more. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much, Raphael. And now we will move to our final speaker, Louisa.
Great, thank you. I feel so tempted to react to what everyone said before me, that I'm now, you know, having this dilemma whether to do that first or to go straight to my couple of bullet points. But just to say one thing on the party politics aspect of that, and this is obviously that far-right parties that have gotten the chance to be part of a government, that's been the case in Bulgaria, but also in other countries in the region, do have this spillover effect of their agendas on the mainstream party. And I think this is the one dangerous thing that probably also Dr. Cooper has looked into in his paper. I haven't looked at it yet, but it's also something that's worthwhile looking at, because these parties are not necessarily representatives of mainstream attitudes and values in the societies. And I want to highlight this particularly because it's very easy to otherwise, you know, fall in the trap of this singular story. Very often when you read the news on our countries, on our region, what is striking you is always, it's either the worst in whatever. So it's either the most corrupt, the poorest, where the rule of law is the worst, et cetera, which doesn't mean that it's not worthwhile paying attention to. But I just want to highlight once again that just like we don't put an equation between Putin and the Russians, we should also not do the same thing when we talk about, parties, some political elites and the people of a certain country. And so when you look at the electoral results in the Bulgarian case for the couple of, for especially the last elections, this small coalition of far-right parties, they didn't even make it to parliament, which I think is pretty much speaks for itself. I see a growing body of research that is trying to make a segmentation within the body of voters for certain parties that we call, you know, conservative / far right. I've seen a segmentation done actually by an LSE team that looks specifically also in the votership of Fidesz to actually show that not all of them approve of all the, the crazy ideas that Orban has in terms of attacking minorities. And so I'm a political scientist by training, but by heart, I'm a civic educator. So I have to start talking about something that Rafał talked about. And this is namely the focus in the years of transition. There was this dichotomy. You had to focus in the years of transition on the elites. So they, part of them were already westernized if they were part of the diaspora, but they had to sort of embrace the liberal idea. So the focus was on basically getting the elites be democratic themselves. And the second one was the focus on the institutions, making institutions democratic, refurbishing them. But the one missing link here is the people. So how do you expect to have liberal democracies in countries where people are predominantly socially conservative? And so some of the reasons for the backlash vis-a-vis the Istanbul Convention or certain policies or initiatives that are rather progressive, you would call them progressive, is simply that people, their value set is simply not there yet. You have to lead part of this back to, you know, this policy or politics of uniformity of communism, where everyone had to be the same. So in a way, you have to put an extra effort in educating diversity and multiculturalism after 89. And so if there has been no focus on people and there is values and attitudes and skills, and there has been hardly civic education, neither in the formal nor in the non-formal sector, you cannot necessarily expect people to have those, you know, to have those civic competences that are needed to be able to you know, to embrace an Istanbul Convention. Some of the other, you know, if I'm trying to basically describe the Bulgarian soul, or in a way, you know, the Eastern, capture the Eastern European soul, the other aspect of it is a notion of, I would call it, social jealousy. So in somehow Bulgarians, but I think also other Eastern Europeans, didn't really experience in the 90s and in the 2000s a sort of a policy of recognition. You know, many of you lost your jobs. There was such a level of insecurity that you all had to run to the fortune tellers to tell you what's going to happen. And so no one really came to say, you know, well done. And you see also this type of behavior then translating also in voter turnout. Look at the voters of the Alternative for Germany, for example. They predominantly, as you know, come also from the Eastern Bundes republics. So the social jealousy basically leads to the fact that many in our countries have these very strong negative sentiments towards the Romani on the first place, then comes to migrants, for example. And this is because you feel like they have been given more attention. They are receiving more on the social end. And this makes you, or this reinforces this sense of anyways being secondhand in the European Union, and now all of a sudden again, you know, because of minority politics. So on the positive side of all of this, as I said, it is also full of a lot of paradoxes, but also does not necessarily translate in any you know, election behavior, electoral behavior that would put these parties, at least in the Bulgarian case, much further up. And then the one thing that I would keep pleading for, both when it comes to supporting civil society in our region, but also when you think about what European institutions could be doing, is on the one hand, do not forget the role of humanities, because this is where you get to learn civic competences and civic behavior. And when you look at, you know, educational policies, which are not necessarily, you know, a question of the institutions, but are a question of where you put an emphasis within employability politics of the EU, always directed into the STEM skill set. And so humanities are always put to the side, but that's very important. And this is why the focus of, you know, the Kaczynskis and the Orbans is going in this direction. It's going in the direction of how you set up your museums. It's going in the direction of how does your history curriculum look like. It goes in the direction of who's holding the authority on the textbooks. And so, you know, that's I think part of the answer. And then last but not least, in a way, you know, because I'm also part of civil society, it does start to feel like cultural wars in a way, but I keep asking myself, and I don't have an answer to this question, what is our role really in civil society? Is it to educate, because that's what we kind of have been doing since the 90s, or is it to represent? Because if we were to represent, then we're actually not very representative. And so I'm leaving it here, and I look forward to the discussion.
Excellent. Thank you, Louisa, and thank you everyone for their interventions. I think the first thing we're going to do now is allow all the speakers an opportunity to engage with some of the points of their fellow speakers, while those in the audience are thinking about what kind of questions they'd like to pose themselves. Just before we go back to our speakers, maybe just a couple of words from me. Clearly, one interesting theme that we may want to talk further about is the extent to which we're dealing with a single phenomenon here. This is, of course, the claim that Luke has framed the discussion with. And I get the impression that, by and large, there is something of a consensus on the panel that we can talk about a general phenomenon here, albeit with a series of asterisks concerning how it plays out in particular countries. Biljana, for example, mentioned the tactics of whether in Bulgaria there is an effort to avoid provoking transnational institutions, for example, that makes it go somewhat more under the radar. A couple of questions I would simply add in addition to anything you want to talk about. What is authoritarianism, protectionism replacing if we go with this concept? Is it taking over from neoliberalism? Or is it a kind of refocusing of neoliberalism from a globalist to something more like a nationalist orientation? To what extent is this a break with a certain kind of economic model or a kind of redesign of it for different purposes? And as I guess another general question that I'd be interested to touch on, to what extent, if we again run with the concept of authoritarian protectionism as a kind of umbrella category, is this a stable ideology? Are we talking about something which can persist in its current form, or is it inherently radicalizing or in transition to some other type of politics? How will it contend with its own challenges or limitations? We heard Rafael talk about, you know, the idea of an internationalist nationalism, which clearly seems ripe for tensions, as well as potentially quite a productive politics for those engaged in it. But there are also clearly economic tensions that are likely to come to fore over time. Are we talking about a stable formation, or are we talking about something that is in a kind of perpetual evolution? And if so, where's it going? That's just my tuppence worth, but I'd like to go back to our speakers to see if they have anything that they want to pick up on that others have mentioned in the course of the discussion so far. So let me go first back to Luke.
Thanks, and thanks to all the speakers. That was it's really great to have this conversation. So in reference to this question of what is authoritarianism, protectionism, if we use the framework I've advanced that Jonathan asked, what's it replacing, what's it taking over, is this a break or redesign of the economic model? I would say that this politics is quite a big departure from neoliberalism in two different respects. On the one hand, I think classical neoliberalism ideologically made a very strong meritocratic, aggressively meritocratic argument in its mobilizing discourses. And that went something along the lines that if you work hard and you engage with the market and you're a bit selfish, you know, you look after your family and you try to get ahead and you compete in the market, well, society will be good for you. I think the politics that we're confronting in a lot of countries, and it's not the same everywhere, I think there's a little bit of what I've just advanced in Modi's argument about the Indian middle class rising. It comes across very, it has this very strong individualistic element, which has resonances with classical neoliberalism. I would say in most countries, we get a different set of distributional claims. And I think that's because when inequality reaches very, very high levels, and perhaps the market is not performing in a way that many people expect it to perform, and certainly not the ideologues of neoliberalism originally argued, when markets are seen as dysfunctional, I think politics has to adapt to that, and we get a different claim that's put forward. And the claim that's put forward broadly is that you have a certain set of distributional rights because of your ethnic status. And that's not meritocratic, it's actually unconditional. You don't have to do anything to access this set of rights. Do I think, and I want to hear what the rest of the panel say, so I'll just very briefly, do I think it's a stable phenomenon? Can it last? I think it is a stable phenomenon, probably, and I think it will define our politics for quite a long time to come, and the resistance to it will define that politics too, and the challenge to it. And the reason for that is that I think it falls back on something that's very visceral in many societies, and that's the feelings that nationalism and national identity attract. This is a very default register, if you like, for this new politics. And I think because nations and nationalism are going to be with us for many generations, at least still to come, I think it has a very kind of organic tendency. And I just wanted to say, I agree with Rafał about the Polish case to some degree, especially if you contrast Poland to Hungary. And so in Poland, the far right have really built huge street mobilizations in a way that Orbán's not really interested in. It doesn't have that kind of same active political engagement on the streets and with street mobilizations. And that has allowed Law and Justice, as you describe, to put itself at the center of this kind of far-right civil society, if you like, that's emerging across Europe.
Thank you. Biljana.
To the question, what authoritarian regime is trying to replace? I believe it is trying to replace the lack of security. Very simply said, because through these democratic, neoliberalistic processes, people here, not only here, I believe, have lost their sense for security. Before, during the socialist communist times, everything was pretty much regulated, even over-regulated, and it provided that certain level of security. However, now having a market economy, having all these other features of the neoliberal democracy, people have lost this sense of security, and this is what makes them even more conservative than before. We have seen this disbalance, opening of the scissors, so bright, very rich people, very poor people, and in between there is no middle class, which usually in a normal market, you know, economy and developed democracy provides this level of security. So that is why I believe almost naturally people are turning again to looking for the very strong, powerful figure which can bring them this type of security. And going back to what Dr. Cooper said about the meritocratic principle and meritocracy, we haven't reached to that point yet in Bulgaria. People who are on the decision-taking and leadership positions in the country, regardless if we talk about the executive or the judiciary, even though they are elected through public procedures, these procedures are not transparent, and they are not elected because of their skills and capabilities. They are elected because of nepotism and other hidden connections. And this transforms and projects on the government and on the decision taking and on the well-being of the country. So basically, this lack of security, and I can also add to the very high speed of development of the democracy in the country was too big a thing to swallow for the people here. And we are not there yet where, for example, Poland and Hungary are. So that is why I said that things are different in Southeastern Europe than in Central Europe, although they lead to the same result, being a threat not only for the rule of law, human rights, but a threat also for the very democratic principles of the EU. And the fact that we are geographically on the periphery of the European Union should not mean that we should be left politically and from a social point of view also in that periphery. And just to add to what Luisa mentioned about perhaps the role of the civil society here, the civil society is the active active civil society organizations and persons are these who can actually try to bring back again that security, but without leaning to the authoritarian and far-right and populistic regimes.
Thank you, Rafael.
Well, that's really interesting. I'd like to respond to one or two points that were made. I think it would be interesting to to focus a little bit on the context of the pandemic. If we think back to March last year, the Polish government was one of the first to close the borders. I think it was an instinctive reaction to the pandemic, which may have been justified, and it may have been a right decision, but I think in some ways you could call it an instinctive response dictated by authoritarian protectionism, or protectionist authoritarianism, if you like. And you might think that this kind of response would have served the ruling party okay. Well, yes and no, because what we have seen in the last months is the is the relative success of the political groups to the right of the ruling party, those groups that spread conspiracy theory around the pandemic, including anti-Semitic conspiracy theory around the pandemic, that have capitalized on the pandemic situation in a different way. So I think through legitimizing far-right discourse, the ruling party sort of got the genie out of the bottle, and it is very, very challenging and very difficult to get it back into the bottle. So I think what the ruling party in Poland is facing today, through a lot of the mistakes that they have made in terms of legitimizing different types of far-right discourse, they are now facing a challenge from parties that are even more nationalistic or more authoritarian to the right of the ruling party, and I think that is one of the paradoxes of the current situation. I also want to mention, Luisa alluded to the issue of humanities, and I think I can relate to it to that. Thinking about the broader issue of education as well as higher education in Poland today. So I know that may be sounding shocking to you, but let me quote one politician who played the big role in the presidential campaign last year, who said repeatedly and publicly about on television about LGBT people, he said, these are not normal people, let's stop all this nonsense about human rights and equality. And it's a precise quote. A few months later, he was rewarded with a post of Minister of Education. And he is running the Ministry of Education and Higher Education today, and he is rapidly changing the school curriculum as well as rules of higher education institutions, which I think shows how directly the far right can affect and undermine the very principles, the very fundamental principles of the of education, understood as a humanist as a humanist enterprise. And I'm afraid you know we are facing this challenge in a very direct way, in a very crude way. And of course we can, you know, we can have a very refined intellectual debate about it, but at the end of the day we are faced with some very crude and very direct and very radical challenges here. Thank you
Rafael, and finally Luisa.
Great, thank you. I think I heard Biljana say this, but to your question, what is this far-right tide replacing? I think it really gives an answer to the sense of fear. And I think we're at a moment in history where all of a sudden people are more anxious and more afraid of the future than of the past. But when you look at democracy and all our institutions, they're actually based on the premises of the never again of the past. But now suddenly the past becomes so comfortable that it's like that actually you're much more afraid of what is coming. And then I'm sorry that I keep coming back to the skill set, but I don't think people have acquired the skill set that is helping them get through this constant sense of transformations. So, and it's a constant sense of transformations, but also of crises. And even if in our circles we're calling these things challenges and try to look for the opportunities, people are really afraid. They're afraid of losing their jobs. They're afraid of all the changes that are happening. And so what you're trying to do is you're looking for the roots. And then it's also a natural reaction, human reaction, to look for, you know, the uniformity. So you look for what you're acquainted with. We look for the things that you're comfortable with. And so this makes it rather easy for, you know, all those quite simplistic, but yet apparently very successful messages of different either populists or then also far right parties. Whether this is a stable trend, I think it's pretty difficult to predict. And I think also indirectly answering one of the questions in the chat, I think comparison is good for making sure that probably, you know, countries do not fall out of people's agenda and attention. But then they should be also taken case by case because there are differences. And here again, I think we should look into the different countries and try to understand really how deeply rooted have these elites and parties gotten to be, and also what is the type of opposition that they get from civil society or society that is differently minded. Because as earlier Biljana pointed to the protest waves in Bulgaria, I think this was a really lucky coincidence and a perfect storm in the sense of the pandemic kept people at home for many months, plus a lot of young people whose obviously mindset has been changed while they were studying abroad came back home. And this is also one of the reasons why people took it to the street, not only in Sofia, but also in other cities across the country. Because I can tell you from a civic health index that my organization has just developed, it is a minority of Bulgarians that actually recognize protest as a meaningful way of changing anything in society. Bulgarians say that they're ready to go to vote. It's like the majority of people recognize elections as the instrument of civic participation. But then for quite some time, no other instrument comes to their mind, which gets me back to the, you know, to the civic competences and why I think they're so crucial.
Great, thanks very much. So we've got some questions coming in from the audience, and what I plan to do is the following. I'll cluster a few questions and then I'll let speakers intervene as they would like on the questions that they particularly want to come back on. So let me read out I think three questions to begin with, which are accumulating here in the chat. The first one from Dimitrina Ivanova, who writes the following: while I understand the emphasis on external EU institutional solutions in the case of Bulgaria, I wonder about the extent of domestic and more local democratic solutions. Are the latest election results a realistic opportunity for dismantling of captured structures? Or perhaps due to the nationalistic character of the possibly would-be winners, we are still witnessing more of the same threats to democracy that Dr. Cooper talked about. So a question there, I guess, on the balance between EU responses and local domestic responses. I have another question here from Joshua Tal. Is it possible to effectively delegitimize authoritarian protectionism given the prevalence of insular communities and paradoxically pan-European nationalist groups? What would delegitimization look like in this context? And then thirdly, from someone called Xin Zuo, how should European democracies respond to many voters' disillusionment with democratic values, which partly contributes to the rise of far-right ideology? So I take that to be a question which touches on a number of points people have made about underlying attitudinal bases of the appeal of the political currents that we're talking about. So any of our speakers who would like to come in on one or several of these questions, please gesticulate wildly and I will hand over to you, or otherwise I will go around one by one. But does anyone want to come in first on any of these?
Well, I can if you like. Well, I'll say on in reference to the local and international response, and it relates to something that Biljana said earlier, the European Public Prosecutor's Office is a really big step forward for fighting corruption in Europe. And Europe really needs such a step forward. I mean, its anti-sanctions regime for corruption is much weaker than the Magnitsky sanctions regime in the United States. It doesn't have anything equivalent to Magnitsky sanctions for corruption. So this is a really important institutional development. And with a Romanian becoming the European head public prosecutor, this is a really nice example. And I put a link that expands on this in the chat. This is a really nice example of change coming from the periphery to the center of Europe, a mass public pressure for action and protest against the social democratic regime, public prosecutors in Romania playing a really strong role in really pushing a number of anti-corruption cases against politicians. So you see civic mobilization working in tandem, and so it's a positive that we should generalize. And the other comment I was going to make, I think relates to this and what Louisa has just said. It's really interesting to hear, and yeah, it's been a fascinating conversation for me to hear about all of these examples, but your comment about the civic health index that you've established and Bulgarians showing more support for elections as a civic act compared to protest. It just reminds me a lot, I know it's a very different case, but it does remind me a lot of the research I did in Hong Kong, where for a long time there was this tremendous, huge civic mobilization in terms of participation, but it was always a really active minority in society, in the sense that for most people who are pretty cautious, pretty small C conservative, weren't very keen to rock the boat. But it was over time, with the course of events, that civic mobilization really started to dominate the politics of the country. And I was going to ask you, is there a sense in which something akin to that? I know the Hong Kong case has a very bad ending, if you like, but leaving that to one side, is there something similar perhaps in Bulgaria, in the sense that this civil society protest movement, which even might at some point find a political outlet? And the very last point is that I think the way that corruption is talked about in Central and Eastern Europe is a really important compared to Western Europe, i.e. especially in a country like ours, the UK. You know, if you mention corruption in politics, that's considered a disgraceful act. In a lot of European countries, to get into politics, the first thing you need to do is to say you're against corruption. And so the way that the debate is framed, I think, is much better on your side than on our side, because you know, if you're living in a political context where mentioning corruption is kind of forbidden in public debate, you are presumably at risk of allowing corruption when it happens.
Thank you, Luke.
Hello. If I can add a couple of words, okay. On the question about the values, and I also saw in the Q&A part something about what the EU should do. So perhaps the European Union should think of rebranding itself somehow. Because at the moment it looks like it does not do what it is preaching. We talk, or the EU talks about the union of values, but when it comes to establishing really functioning mechanisms to keep these values, we suddenly see that the values have a price tag, and that countries like ours or Poland and Hungary can kind of circumvent all these procedures and continue to be taking part in the whole decision taking and decision making processes on the at the European institutions. The other thing which I wanted to mention and also present as a concept, something which we have discussed with other colleagues here in Bulgaria working in the area of judicial and legal reform, is the fact that when we don't have public institutions which are really representative and working for the public interest, perhaps we should turn to the court and talk about judicial populism in the positive way of populism. Because the court, if not a representative institution for the public, can still be the most highly qualified institution which can represent the values which the public in our society wants and cherishes. That is why I have mentioned as another idea the possibility to increase the jurisdiction and to broaden the powers of the European Court of Justice. And I strongly believe that there should be a political consolidation around this idea, because in that situation, if that happens, this might change the narrative and change the discourse on the EU level and bring back the faith of the people to the EU institutions.
Thank you. Rafael or Luisa, do you want to come in on any of these points?
If I may, let me start by addressing the question of civil society. Of course, it has been mentioned many times over the last years that, you know, one good thing about the Polish situation is the existence of a vibrant civil society, and that includes civil society protest against nationalist populism or authoritarianism, and you know, we have seen many spectacular examples of mass protest against certain moves or certain policies, but I'm afraid at the end of the day, when you have this kind of mass movement, you kind of expect success, and if you don't obtain success, I think disappointment is very bitter. And there is this kind of anticlimax, which I think is also important, and it can also be quite quite negative. So I think obviously it is very important to sustain civil society, independent civil society, but in itself it is not a solution to a crisis of democracy, or not the only solution. And I also want to say, of course, for countries in Central and Eastern Europe, countries like Poland, the European Union is a very important point of reference, and the European institutions are a very important point of reference. But again, I would say the reaction to the crisis of democratic values from the European Union institutions hasn't really had much impact, meaningful impact, to be frank. And I think we are also witnessing a kind of anticlimax in terms of expectations from the pro-European public opinion in Poland. But I also wanted to say something positive for once, and I thought, well, actually we are now right in the middle of the European Football Championships. Okay, Poland is out, unfortunately, but I think we have seen some really good spectacular examples of human rights advocacy from football players. I think especially German players, also English players, the England team, in support of the Black Lives Matter movement, in support of the gay rights movement. And I think that is actually very important, almost as important as any reaction we could expect from the European Union institutions. Popular culture is very significant in terms of setting standards and projecting certain values. So I think it's a positive it's a positive example. It's a positive tournament in this sense. Thanks.
Thank you, Rafał. I'll go to Louisa, and then I'm going to take some more questions from the audience. Louisa.
Right. I took so many notes from what the other panelists said that I'm almost lost and then wondering where to hit it off. Luke Cooper had a question on whether protests got to produce a kind of a party. One directly from the protests, another one pretty anti-systemic. And this one, the one that I would call anti-systemic, is actually about to be the strongest party. But I'm not really sure that I would totally be in favor of this party putting together the next government, which might actually be the case. So it's a party I think many like me are highly suspicious of, because it's a very, it's totally based on the type of campaign that someone like Trump would do. But it's basically also doing only that. It's talking to its votership through a political talk show, through public, through songs, because its leader is a talk show person and a musician, and through social networks. And so I really don't know what we should expect from that from that one. But for that matter, I think one realization for civil society has been that there is no way it doesn't get in a way its hands dirty. So civil society became politicized. There are colleagues from civil society that are joining politics, running for elected offices, and I think this has been one of the developments. Then on the European institutions, how they're living, their values, and whether they are or not, I am thinking of the fact that, Rafał mentioned, European institutions continue to be, at least in Bulgaria, the most popular institutions at all. And so this is because Bulgarians do not trust their parties, they do not trust their parliament. These, by the way, are the two institutions that have the least, enjoy the least trust in society. Parties, it's on a scale of 5, I think 1 or 2 make up 12%. So 12% of people trust parties. I hope there is no Bulgarian politician on this event, because they're not going to like this. and the parliament enjoyed 18%. This is polls from March this year. But European institutions, even if there was a small setback now around the pandemic, they still enjoy a very high trust, because Bulgarians feel like these are the only institutions that can make their own politicians accountable, hold them accountable. I also wanted to talk, you know, these are kind of scattered thoughts, but one thing that I definitely wanted to mention is how, you know, the whole notion of how proximity, but also travel enabled by the European Union helps fight prejudices. And I'm not saying this, you know, to have this sort of very optimistic EU type of speak. But I've been looking again at the data from the Civic Health Index that I mentioned previously. And interestingly, people in the capital are the most skeptical when it comes to different forms of others versus villages, where people are the least skeptical of others. So you can argue, of course, that in the villages, you don't necessarily meet too many others. So, you know, there is no reason for you to be skeptical. But I'm thinking of exactly the opposite. In villages, you get to actually meet people and talk to people, whereas in the capital, the chance that you're encapsulated and living in your Facebook feed bubble is much bigger. So if anything, I think there might be, and I'm sure there is data on the positive impact of all the Erasmus Plus and free rail programs, et cetera, that are actually supporting to counter prejudices. At the same time, I am looking at the infrastructure of some of our countries. And I can bet with you that these areas that research calls civic deserts, so the structurally weak regions, the most remote ones, the peripheral, the former imperial borders, they might actually end up being the most supportive of far-right ideas, because they tend to be remote and not very, very well connected, and there is hardly a possibility of exchange with people that are of different background than theirs.
Thank you, Louisa. I'm going to take another three questions, and then I will go back to each of the panelists who can pick up what they want to from the questions and also say anything they'd like to say in the way of final remarks on the topic. So I've got a G. Leslie here who poses a question that touches on a theme we've briefly touched on, to do with whether this is something long-term, whether this is a phase. Is this authoritarian tilt just a temporary blip, part of an electoral cycle, or a serious challenge which EU democracies and other Western democracies must challenge in a forthright manner, potentially with strong sanctions? And how realistic is it to think that the tilt can be reversed? So a number of aspects there, but are we talking about a phase and the kind of responses that follow on from that diagnosis? Got something from Robert Anderson here saying, I think Luke Cooper's point about the flowering of civil resistance to the radical right is very important. Why is this fight back happening in this region much more arguably than in Western and Southern Europe? So something perhaps we certainly should say a little bit more about the response to the politics we've been describing as much as the authoritarian protectionism itself. And finally, Frank Mulhall asked the following: are the panel concerned that there is an opaque peddling of radicalization strategies and disinformation online by shady and far-right groups funded by wealthy individuals, which will fall beyond the influence of democratic institutions and the law? So are there further currents beyond those that we've been discussing that would have to be engaged with in any adequate response to the politics in question? I'm going to go back then to our panelists. And as I say, if you could engage with the questions that you would like to, and anything else that you want to say by way of final remarks as we come up to the last minutes of the event. Luke.
Yes. So is it long term or a phase? Well, I would say it's long term, but experience up till now demonstrates that civic movements and democratic institutions can resist this if they are vigilant and if they are active. And I think I would connect that to this civic resistance question. And the, as I said, in response to Robert Anderson's question in the Q&A. So what, why is this happening? Why is this mass civic resistance happening in Eastern and Central Europe? But we're not necessarily seeing the same level of mobilization in Western European countries. I think that that's in some ways the million-dollar question. In a way, it's such a big question, it's difficult to answer. But I think it's important in the first instance to register that this has happened in Central and Eastern Europe and that we should be talking about it much more. And I suppose one country which you would be worried about in Western Europe, obviously very influential in terms of European politics in general, is France, looking forward to the next elections. You know, I said to someone at the workshop I was at this week that, you know, we should really be looking at and learning from and talking to civic movements in Central and Eastern Europe, because there seems to be a lot more happening there on these issues that we're discussing than in Western Europe. And they said, well, they've got more to mobilize against, haven't they? Fairly innocent response. And I really don't think that that's true. I said to him, you know, look, I mean, Marine Le Pen is in touching distance of winning the next French presidential election. I mean, I think there's a dangerous complacency now. And so I think that links back to flip back to this long-term or phase question. If I was to end on a positive note, I would say I used to be of the view that if Marine Le Pen, and I'm not saying it's likely, I'm just saying it's become a possibility, does win the next French presidential election, you know, there is, that would be certainly a huge shock to European democracy, and it would be a massive moment in European politics, and I hope that it doesn't happen. But I think the evidence that we have in other cases is democratic institutions can withstand this if publics are able and willing to mobilize in very large numbers against this authoritarian politics. So, you know, it wouldn't be the end of the European Union. The European Union would withstand it. There would be a great danger that some of the worst tolerances of authoritarianism would be strengthened again, but there would also be huge resistance from other democratic states. You know, we would have to push for a response that was every bit at least as significant as the far right entering government in Austria in 1999, you know, some form of diplomatic sanctions and challenge to the far right taking power in France. But European institutions, I think, would be able to withstand and deal with this. So I think, you know, for a while it was in the height of the Eurozone crisis and everything, migration crisis, you know, there was all this talk of disintegration and collapse. You know, the European Union has demonstrated that it has the power to withstand a lot of these challenges from the far right and endure. And yes, there's a danger of drift to authoritarianism, but it's not so much disintegration as both European and national fora, you know, becoming centres of argument and conflict between progressive democrats and authoritarian forces. And that seems to me will continue for many, many years ahead. This is going to be a very much a long-term politics that we're living with.
Thank you, Luke. Biljana.
While listening to Dr. Cooper, I thought about an article I've read in 2007 when Bulgaria became a member of the European Union, and the article was that once countries from the Balkans start becoming full-fledged member of the European Union, this will be the end of the European Union because it will balkanize itself somehow. Listening to all the other speakers and observing the processes here in Bulgaria, I can say that on the contrary, what is happening now in South Europe might be the solution for the problems which the European Union is facing. Namely, a strong civil society, young generation which is returning with a change mindset and which is really demanding and looking for its representation. Is it just a single thing, or will it be a long process? I tend to believe that the process will deepen. The process with the authoritarian regimes and challenging the core values of the European Union. But from what was said previously from my colleagues and what I've mentioned in my presentation about these four ideas, I really believe that the key to solving these problems lies, I can say, a higher level of federalization of the European Union, more unified institutions to defend these values, judicial populism in the positive way I trying to explain very briefly, and this very active civic actors which will not allow the processes to become inevitable. And one last point, I think Luisa mentioned about the others and this otherness. We should try to change the narrative so that the people in the populistic, nationalistic spectrum or the far right spectrum don't think about us as the others, because I tend to get the feeling that in Bulgaria we are the others, being the Soros suites or the spies of foreign countries and so forth. If we can change also this type of narrative and avoid this labeling with the otherness, I think this is also one way to tackle all the issues which we have discussed in this panel. Thank you.
Thank you, Rafael.
Thanks. Well, I wanted to return to the global context. I am a member of a civil society organization, the Never Again Association, that also has cooperation and projects in countries of Southeast Asia. And of course, until recently, you know, we could talk about Poland as an example of successful democratic transformation, and that is much more difficult today. In the context of Thailand or Cambodia, you know, Poland is no longer the model country, I'm afraid. But I still think we have some important experiences to share. Like Luke said, we have some civil society activism that can be inspiring to others. I think, but if we think about Poland, I think I'm afraid the year 2015 was the watershed year, and we are not just talking about electoral cycles. We are talking about a much more profound change that has taken place, and actually I'm really hoping everything I'm saying is incorrect, but I do think that that something major really happened and really changed in Poland in 2015. And I'm not just talking about the change of government and the elections, but I'm talking about the impact of the European refugee crisis, which, as we know, did not really affect Poland directly, because very few of those refugees even intended to go to Poland. But it was framed in a very negative way in media and in political discourse, and it resulted in a big change of social attitudes and a big rise of xenophobia on a scale that we haven't, you know, we did not see before, and I think we are still experiencing repercussions of that moment and that very big change in social attitudes, which fuel nationalist populism and fuel the forces of authoritarianism until today. And if you ask me about future, I think many of us are familiar with the motto of Gramsci: you need to be a pessimist of the intellect but an optimist of the will. There is another phrase from a Polish commentator. I don't want to mention his name, but he said, well, what is the difference between the optimist and the pessimist? The pessimist says it cannot get any worse, and the optimist says yes, it can. And I'm afraid I'm a little bit of an optimist in this context, and I really hope I am I'm wrong here. Thanks.
Thank you, Rafael and Luisa.
Thank you. So before the final a couple of remarks, I just wanted to say something that I forgot in the very beginning, to say how grateful I am for this opportunity to actually talk about Bulgaria, to see that it's two of us on this panel. I'm not sure whether this is good or bad, but to especially say that I think this might be also part of the fact that this is a Ratio Forum event as well. So this is a beautiful foundation from and in Romania that is interested in the region. So just to say how happy I am that there are that type of institutions that are a kind of homegrown philanthropy that is interested in what's going on. And then to turn to three more things. I think when we keep talking about whether the people of Central Eastern Europe are racist, homophobic, et cetera, it's a plea to both, you know, philanthropies, but also to civil society colleagues to try have a focus on what is homegrown and what is in a way imported from abroad. Because this the type of speak, you know, whether we're Soros-oids or all civil society actors are, you know, living off grants, but they're basically, you know, not doing what they're supposed to, but they're just, you know, buying off beautiful apartments. It's, you know, this is not a homegrown thing. So that's been imported over social networks conversations that people just basically buy off because there is the lack of critical thinking. And so it's necessary to keep this in mind, because some things you can really work with them on the ground and others are to be addressed on a totally different scale. So that's the one thing. The second point is kind of a personal obsession with the notion of self-efficacy. So if, you know, all the talk of civic competences and what's important and whatnot, I think if this is the one thing we can focus on, I would tell basically, let's try to really empower people to a place where they're able of, you know, basically taking their own lead of their own business, whether it's in critical thinking, whether it's in they're making up their minds of how to vote, whom to go to vote for, etc. And the third and last point is to also addressing one of the comments in the chat. It is about how important it is to invest in people's power of imagination in times when they're afraid or in times of crises. Because what I have observed in this year and a half, and we kept having capacity building programs for locally rooted active citizens, you know, in villages and remote areas in Bulgaria, is that it's not that people don't want to, you know, be the change on the local level, it's just that they lack the imagination often. And I'm thinking okay, I might be willing to actually give up on civic education and become a total proponent of literature and whatever is actually in being able to boost this power of imagination, to be able to imagine different places, the future, different people's lives, and then be empathic.
Great. Thanks very much, Louisa. We've come to the end of our allotted time. So I would like to thank all our speakers, Luke, Biljana, Rafael and Louisa, for some very interesting and stimulating discussion, I thought. I'd like to thank the Ratio Forum and LSE Ideas. And of course, I'd like to thank also our audience members and their interventions in the Q&A. I hope you enjoyed the event, and I wish you a good evening.